Welcome to the Big Self Podcast. I'm your host, Chad Prevost.
And I'm your host, Shelley Prevost. We are the podcast for the Big Self School, and we offer classes, coaching, books, and media to help you live a more purposeful life.
We could all use a little more of that in our lives. And today we speak with Karen Nimmo, a registered clinical psychologist with a private practice in Wellington, working in adolescent and adult mental health. She also has a background in physical education. And in a former life, Karen was a print journalist and media consultant. She works primarily in performance and life coaching. And as a clinical psychologist, she is able to assess, diagnose, and treat psychological problems where required. She is trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, but draws on a range of models and tools to match individual needs.
I absolutely loved this conversation and Karen's authenticity, and I think you will too.
Karen, welcome to the show.
Hey, Karen.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we're so glad you're here.
It is great to have you. You have an interesting biography. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You went from being a print journalist and a media consultant to becoming a clinical psychologist with all kinds of degrees. What led you out of journalism and into psychology?
Well, the truth is I was interested in psychology back when I left school, but to be honest, the idea of being a 20-something-year-old psychologist absolutely terrified me.
Interesting. Yeah. Why is that?
Well, the thought of giving people advice. I looked quite young back then, not so much these days, but I thought people would look at me and think I had no credibility whatsoever. So
gotcha. I get that.
And went and became a journalist, which, to be fair, I absolutely loved. It's a really fun job, and it teaches you to talk to all sorts of people, which becomes quite handy in whatever you go into.
Okay.
I feel like I kind of went the other way, I have had that writing desire my whole life and then pursued psychology. So kind of came at it a little bit backwards. So, and I actually was just looking through your stuff and I was like, oh, Chad, you can just sit this one out. Me and Karen have a lot to talk about.
I think we have a lot, but you're right.
Yeah, there is so much to dive into. I wanted to start here, Karen, if I could. And so I'm an educational psychologist I have a clinical master's degree and haven't practiced in a while. But during this pandemic, of course, you know, I think I have seen so many people coming out of the woodworks, like needing to really talk and grapple and understand kind of what is happening around them. So I wanted to see if you could just share a little bit about your experience in New Zealand, kind of how you all are coping with it, have coped with it. And what are some words that you can offer maybe that you have even shared with some of your own clients to help people who are really struggling with the stress and mental health of this right now? And I realize New Zealand's probably, I know you all are in a bit of a different place than we are here in the States, but we're still pretty tragic. I mean, there's still a lot of upheaval that people are in right now. So how are you helping people? Maybe what could you share with our community about how they could not just survive, but thrive during this time?
Yes, I know what you mean. I have a few friends in the States and, you know, they're still in lockdown, which is unbelievable to us because that's months. Whereas we went into lockdown quickly and sort of bobbed out of it and have been back a little bit, back and forth. But it's put enormous stress on everybody worldwide, hasn't it? Because of not just the fear of coronavirus, but the uncertainty that it's led to. And that's what's showed up in therapy, as you'll know, Shelley. People often are coming along at the moment with other reasons, but coronavirus and COVID has really triggered something in them. It might be that they want to change their lives, that they're not happy with what they had, or just that ongoing fear of what might happen. And, you know, that's a huge thing in therapy anyway. So I think this year and the washout of everything that's happened is going to be something really tough on our mental health. And there's going to be a lot of training around tolerating distress and learning to live alongside uncertainty, because that's what we're all going to have to do. Resilience is the thing right now, and we all need tools for that.
That is true. What are some cutting edge techniques that you use with clients for coping with stress and building resilience, Karen?
Well, cutting edge, interesting term there, Chad. My tools are more probably things for life. So, I have things like, they sound a bit sort of strange, like the pizza of life, for example, which is about being able to balance yourself and all the demands that are on you. I use a pyramid for sorting out who matters in your life and your priorities. Things like traffic lights to work out what you can control and what you can't control. And the obvious ones, of course, like mindfulness for being present and helping people to reframe their situation and, you know, who they are as people. All those kind of things are essential. With resilience, you know, you absolutely have to think and think flexibly and to be adaptable. And for some people, that's a really big challenge. So, you know, it's all about looking at the person who's in front of you and then building something that works for them.
Could you walk us through your traffic light exercise a little bit? Because I hear that so much. Like, people really are struggling with that, what they can and cannot control. And almost it's like this death grip on control in the face of so much adversity. I think there's a lot of us, me included, a lot of times where I want to hold on to things tighter and harder because it gives me this feigned sense of control over something. And those are usually the things that I need to let go of the most. So I'm curious kind of how do you help people think of that? Like, what would be the red, green, yellow, and kind of terms of what can I and can I not control?
Yeah, that's why I use the traffic lights, because you really need to make that simple for people. You're right, there's a lot of confusion, and we tend to grip to what we know in terms of confusion. So with the traffic lights, it's very simple. It's just you think about what's stressing you out or worrying you, and then you slap a light on it depending what it is. So let's say it's something you absolutely can't control, like COVID. You slap a red on that. But you would slap a green on the things that you can do, like maintain your hygiene, wash your hands, that sort of thing. So you actually are able to divide it up. You can't manage the spread of the disease, but you can do your piece of it. The yellows are the little bit in between where it's uncertain. And that's, you know, that's the time we talk to people and get some advice and help, because that's the bit that messes with people's heads. But oftentimes, if you take the time to separate it out, it's a lot clearer to you.
Yeah, I like that. I use the PIP method, which is put it in perspective method, where, you know, what is the worst case scenario of the situation? Like, and I have people dump out, like, what is the potential worst case of COVID-19, like I could lose somebody or I could die. Like I think that's where a lot of people, or my business could go bankrupt. I could lose my house. And there's something about that act of just putting them out there, give some perspective to people, because then what I ask them to do is, okay, what's the best case scenario? And the best case scenario, I think of like, well, okay, this goes away tomorrow. We have a vaccine, like it's eradicated and we never have to talk about it again. And then the next step is kind of, well, what's the most realistic? And for people to really kind of dance between those three, because it is something about when we don't put language to it, we're not using our full brain and we get really caught up in the fear of what we can't control. So these practices, these little exercises, I think really do help people think through it a little bit more rationally.
Absolutely. It's really important because, you know, there's mass confusion and it will get worse as time goes on. But there are always things, I always say to people, just ask yourself, what can I do today to cope? Because that often just brings them back into the present.
Right.
Allowing your mind to spin out into possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. What can I do today to cope? Yeah. You know, that, yeah, I love that.
And that's as simple as it can get.
Yeah. Because it is so complicated, right? And we create so much story and then it stokes our anxiety. Like, keeping it simple, keeping it behavioral, like what is right in front of my face that I can have some control over.
Yeah. exactly.
I love that.
Well, and also you are no stranger to very hard times and having to develop some resilience yourself. You're very open about how your husband was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and you've got a recent book about it, which we'll talk about, put in our show notes. What was that experience like for your family, and what were some of the mind games that you noticed that might have been surfacing as you all endured that time?
Well, you're right. It was absolutely frightening, as anybody who's been down that path knows. You know, he had a bad back, a sore back, which morphed into a bad back. And then I took him to the hospital one morning because it was really sore. And within the space of a day, we'd found out he had tumours in his back and his stomach, and the back tumour was squeezing his spine, so he was paralysed. So within a day, you know, our whole life had been turned upside down. And, you know, the sense of panic that anybody gets when they're in that situation, I was thinking, how am I going to hold this together? How is he going to work? How am I going to work? Where are we going to get money? What if he dies? And also the other question, which is people often don't think about, is what if he lives? You know, I had this strong, fit, capable husband who suddenly turned into a, you know, tiny, shrunken, bald guy in a wheelchair who needed me for absolutely everything. So, you know, I was in this space where I'm supposed to know as a psychologist how to cope. But quite frankly, when it's you, you know, you really feel like you're in it up to your neck. So we had to figure out a plan, how to keep those mental ghosts, if you like, at bay. And that's eventually what led me to write the book, because I wrote a plan that we could sort of stick to, partly just to keep my own head on straight, but just to help us and our kids and our family and friends to manage their way through it.
Would you share some of that with us? Kind of what was the framework or the roadmap that you all used to get through such a difficult time?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Like, we had teenagers, and teenagers have got their own lives and stuff going on. And, you know, there are times when I think as a mother, I probably didn't serve them as well as I could, but, you know, I did the best I could. But, you know, it's all about trying to stay in the day, stay on the day that you're on. It's about trying to think about what you can do. So my husband had a big sign that he wrote and put up in front of him, think about what you can do, not what you can't, because, you know, he was a fit golfer and things, and suddenly he's in this wheelchair. We did little things like I put a golf club in the corner of the room for him so he could have something to kind of aim for, just to remind him that he was still a person. And when he could stand up, he would hobble over and get the golf club and do some putting. You know, we would, after chemotherapy, we would always plan to do an event that didn't remind us of cancer. You know, all sorts of little tips and tricks that we added into the mix as we went, which was psychologically based, because as anybody knows, when you face serious illness, they very much go after the disease or the physical problem, and there's not much help for the mind games. And the mind games are the things that really mess you up, because that's what wakes you up in the night and keeps you awake all night and makes you anxious and fearful and eventually depressed and that kind of thing. So it's essential to have a plan if you get in that situation.
You know, I know you talk a lot about and have written about the mind-body connection, and you work with that in your practice. I'm interested in, because when you talk about mind games with a physical illness, like, to me, that's part of where my thinking goes too, is like, what did you become aware of with that mind-body connection? And maybe that's part of what influenced some of these practices of staying in the day and, you know, giving yourself something to look forward to. So just kind of, I guess I'm asking generally if you could talk about the mind-body connection and kind of your work and your thinking around that, and then specifically how that came out with your husband and his illness.
That's quite a big question, Shelley, but okay.
That's how I roll, Karen. I ask these big questions.
Okay, let's do this. I think, I mean, in my work, I mean, obviously, as you know, as a therapist, you can't treat a woman for depression without knowing about her life and about knowing all that's going on. You can't treat someone for an eating disorder without understanding the family dynamics. And when cancer struck, the doctors were very much about, you know, how do we get rid of this, shrink this tumor? How do we save this man's life? And I'm like, aren't you going to ask something about the stress that he was under before this all happened? And I understood, because they only have limited amount of time. You know, they can't sit around examining your life when, you know, you have a tumor growing in your back. But the person is a whole person, and you have to look at every aspect of their life in order to understand who they are, in order to figure out a really good treatment plan. So that's what I do in my therapy. I think holistically in terms of the body, what's going on, because often, as you know, stresses will come out in all sorts of ways, in your stomach, with stomach problems, irritable bowel, migraines, all kinds of things. So I think to try and look at them as two separate entities is foolish. People are mind, body and soul, and you have to factor all of those things in if you're going to be able to help them as well as is possible.
Yeah, I used to work at a integrative medical practice as the therapist, and worked alongside, I mean, we had herbalists there, we had acupuncture and obviously physicians, because of exactly what you're talking about. I think it's a lot of the Western tendency to kind of compartmentalize how we treat people, which feels so weird to me, because yeah, like we are whole people, and how, what we're thinking affects how we feel, which has, it houses in our body, like that energy goes somewhere. But I think there's also this tendency for, especially with cancer, I'm curious how you thought through this. I had a good friend who had cancer, and he ended up saying, he's like, I swear it's all the stress I went through for the last 4 years. And I was like, well, that sucks. That feels like really reductive also. Like if you had just kind of taken care of the stress in your life and felt better and took care of your mind, then you wouldn't have ever had cancer. So I think it's a really interesting truth that I think I grapple with. Like there is absolutely that connection, but then sometimes just like really crappy things happen to people, like stage four cancer. And so I don't think can be explained away by, you know, the mind or how we didn't take care of what we were thinking or feeling as well as we could have.
I totally agree with that. I mean, you know, a lot of people said to us when Kev was really sick that, you know, keep a positive attitude, that'll get you through. But in fact, you know, he had many friends that had cancer at the same time. Well, they weren't friends before, but obviously he met them through treatment. And a lot of them had very good attitudes and were positive, but they have all died, every one of them. So, you know, it's a little bit random, and you're right. Sometimes bad things happen to good people and there's no real explanation. And that's the trouble with trying to figure out the stress factor. Mm-hmm. There's no actual evidence. We're kind of going a bit on gut feel, and so it's quite hard to make medical professionals see it that way or take it seriously sometimes.
How is your husband, Karen? Is he okay?
He is well. He is well. When we got out of the treatment, one doctor probably unwittingly said to us, you'll be lucky if you get 3 years, because it was a thing that there's no cure for. But,
wow.
You know, we've had 7 years and we can't believe our luck, because as I said to you, all those friends that he went through the treatment with have died. And so, you know, incredible luck, I guess. You know, I like to think it was a wee bit of what we did to help him, but I still think, you know, largely we just were one of those ones that slipped through the net.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad he's okay and well. And
we still live with that, as many people do, that uncertainty, because, you know, no one will ever say at any point you're cured. It lurks there. So we've learned to manage that sort of uncertainty and to be a bit, you know, be a bit kinder to each other and to try to celebrate, you know, what we do have. He managed to see his kids graduate university, which, you know, I thought that was well beyond, that was never going to happen. So, you know, you have to remind yourself sometimes when you get a lucky break that you have been extraordinarily, you should be thankful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gratitude, right?
Sure.
Yeah. The, the book is Fish Pie is Worse Than Cancer, A True Story of Love, Hope, and Rat-Like Cunning.
Love it.
They can find it, I know, at Amazon, and I'm sure at your own site as well. I'm sure it was a challenging, but I trust maybe therapeutic experience in writing that memoir.
To be honest, Chad, yes, that's right. That's why I wrote it. I tried to make sense of it, and I kept a journal as we went through it. But, you know, as is always the case, lots of funny things happen when you're going through suffering, and I knew I'd never be able to remember them as well. So I wrote all of the things down, and that fish pie is worse than cancer came from a joke one of the kids made. She was allergic to fish, and somebody left a fish pie on our doorstep, and that's what she said. She said, "Oh, Mom, fish pie is worse than cancer." Okay. So, but you know, you do have a lot of laughs. You do have a lot of memories, that things that bond your family eventually once you get past the anxiety of it. And I just wanted to capture that, make sense of it. But also it helped me to understand the perspectives of some other people. You know, as anybody knows who's been through it, you lose friends and things like that when you go through cancer, not because they're bad people, just because they don't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
By writing it all down, it helped me to sort of balance out my own views and not be bitter or resentful. And by putting those notes in the back about, you know, our plan and how we coped, that's been the rewarding bit, because that's helped a few other people, or I suppose many other people, to be able to get to the other side.
Yeah, well, I bet it has, and I'm glad that that was, a healthy growing experience, as challenging as that was. You know, a lot of people, we are talking about just kind of getting by and developing some resiliency, surviving, but at the same time, a lot of people are also trying to level up. They're trying to be thriving as well. What are some, as we try to do that, as we try to level up in our various ways, what are some mind games that we play as we try to start playing bigger in our own lives?
Interesting question. Yeah, you're right. The mind I always look at it as a muscle, as a thing that you can train, that it can be as ripped and toned as you like to make it. Because the mind is a very wayward thing. If we don't keep it on some sort of leash or keep some boundaries around it, it will go and do whatever it wants. And that can lead us into a lot of trouble. So, you know, we have to, as much as is possible, work to get our thinking straight or manageable, to manage our emotions, that sort of thing. So, you know, depending on who comes to see you, you can develop all sorts of things that will work for them. And, you know, the essential thing is, as Shelley mentioned at the beginning, that self-awareness, being able to understand yourself, to react and how you respond and what your hot buttons are, you know, what you like, what you're good at, all those kind of things help you to develop a mind game that's actually going to work in your favor instead of against you.
So I'm going to throw a zinger at you, Karen, if I can.
Hey, why not?
So I think through this pandemic, there's an element of surviving and kind of just coping and just like, oh God, can we get through this year? And then there's another part that I'm setting goals, and I'm like, one of the things that, and Chad knows this, a lot of people know this, I want to write a book. So I am aware that that's my goal. I'm aware that I have, and have for a very long time, had that desire of kind of leveling up, my work. Like, I really want to put it down into print and distribute it that way. Like, that's a goal. But yet I don't do it, and I haven't done it. And I'm it's a struggle for me. And Chad, we were just talking, and he's like, maybe it's time to write your book. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm too busy. I've got like 50 other things I need to be doing. So like, if I were your client, how would you get me to think about this? Like, what would be some mind tricks or tips, or, you know, when you talk about mind games, for me to maybe think about this a little bit differently so that I could start making some headway with this goal?
Yeah, as well, and I'll add, just is the obstacle the way, or is the obstacle the obstacle?
Well, interesting, isn't it? I mean, you have to, I guess it's how much you want to do it. You know, we always, when we're motivating people, the very best motivators are despair, desperation, disgust. So I'm telling you, you're not, those are not your motivators.
Despair, desperation, disgust. I like it.
That's often why people, you know, they'll say they have to hit rock bottom before they take charge, like lose weight or, you know, address their alcohol issues or whatever it is. Now, in the case of a book, those are not going to be your motivators, are they? I mean, I'm assuming you're not disgusted with yourself for not writing it, but
maybe a little.
I'm a little frustrated that I've been saying for 15 years. It's like, come on, Shelley.
Okay, well, a little frustrated is not going to motivate you as hard as those other things, right? But if you really want to do this, I mean, think to yourself, okay, if another year passes, Shelley, and you haven't done this, what will you think of yourself?
Yeah, I would definitely double down on my frustration. Yeah, and I think that's the thing. It's like, where's the tipping point for me where the frustration gets greater than the complacency, maybe? And I guess I've not reached that tipping point yet.
You haven't, because you haven't made the space for it. Now, all you need to do is make a tiny bit of space for it each day. You know, I could talk to you, that'd be boring to our listeners for us to go.
I don't know. They'd probably love it. Turn the table. Well,
it's nothing that I haven't already said, I bet.
Yeah, I bet. But, you know, you could do today. I know you've only got a little bit of the day left, but you could lay out a piece of paper. You could get some post-it notes. You could put your chapter heads on that, and you could lay them all down on a piece of paper. Step one, you've started. As quick as that. Change can happen in an instant. And, you know, with clients, as you know, we've seen it many times. We've seen people flip over in a heartbeat if they decide. So if you decide, yeah, I'm going to write this book. I know what it's about. I'm going to lay down foundations today. You will do it.
Well, yeah, I like that.
That actually...
some mini steps.
That brings up, and I guess this is kind of a broad question, but it's, you know, how uncomfortable does a person need to get before they can really change and not just say they want to change? I'm sure you've seen it all. It doesn't have to always be life-changing, right? But like what leads someone to get uncomfortable enough?
Well, as I said before, that the despair and the disgust, those are the things that really push people's buttons. That's often why they'll come to therapy and they'll have hit the bottom and they can't go on any longer and they can't stand themselves or whatever it is, those kind of things. But, you know, also sometimes it's just, as I said before, just a decision that you make. So I remember seeing a man who came to me. He was around 60 years old and he came and he said, I've been depressed for 30 years. And I talked to him for a while and he seemed quite upbeat. And I said, you know, you seem fine. Is there a possibility that you're not depressed anymore? You know, you've been carrying this label for a long time, but, you know, I'm not really seeing the evidence for it. And it was really interesting. He looked sort of shocked, went home, spoke to his wife. They both came back the next week. They both sat there in tears because they had been living the life. They'd wrapped their life around his label of depression for 30 years. No one had told him that, you know, depression can actually pass and lift off. It probably lifted off after about a year for him. And he'd shaped his whole life around this being depressed.
Around that story.
Yeah, in an absolute heartbeat, he changed and his life opened up. You know, he came back for a couple more sessions, but quite frankly, he didn't need it. He was away and so was she. And they were absolutely terrified because they didn't know how to live without depression.
Wow, that's really powerful. That's potent. Because I do think about, like, you know, and even my little book story, like the stories that we tell ourselves that we've built up in some way. I think for me, a little bit of my book writing resistance is the story that it's going to suck.
Yeah.
So absolutely. I'll just keep in this hamster wheel of saying I'm going to write this amazing book someday and living in this story And I love that. It almost makes me tear up a little bit, like the confrontation of the story in a loving way, in a loving, you know, relationship like he had with you, can be some of the most powerful things that we give people as helpers and therapists.
I agree. I think labels and framing is so dangerously powerful. Like a woman, I saw a woman just the other day who had carried with her whole life, she's 50 odd, a story that she was big and fat. And, you know, I said to her, what about if we said tall and strong? Because that's exactly what she was. And she just sort of stared at me like, is that possible? And it totally was. You know, she was a tall, strong woman, but because she latched on to big and fat, it was governing her whole life. It was filling her head from morning till night. It was sad.
And I think sometimes it is that simple, right? We choose how to believe. Like beliefs can be changed. That's the nature of a belief. It's like these thoughts though over time that we construct, and then they're reinforced because that's the story we're living. But just as easily as we build those stories, we can change them. And I do. I think we have to like participate in this self-confrontation. And sometimes we just need somebody to point it out to us, which makes me think like, you know, even asking our audience, like, what is the story that you all are living that you need some help to confront?
I totally agree.
Yeah, a rhetorical question for all you people listening.
And so for you, Shelley, you could go, I am a writer. And then to use that other tool, you could add, so what am I going to do today to be a writer?
Yeah.
It sounds a little like some like almost like having just that self-compassion, a way of reframing how we talk to ourselves with a little bit more affirmation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is I think that alone is a positive, a very, you know, powerful takeaway, and one of the techniques that you do. You know, I guess, Karen, like, you know, how do you teach your clients to do more listening? We have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of techniques, a lot of advice, a lot of talking. What are some ways that you teach them to do just greater listening?
Well, you're right, Chad. Listening is everything. You know, I always think in my session, if I'm talking more than my client, then I'm really in trouble. We should listen far more than we talk. After all, we already know what we think ourselves, don't we? And by listening, we can pick up another viewpoint. You know, with clients, it's not just the telling of their story, or not just the story itself, but it's the way they tell it that often gives you so much information. So, you know, when you're with someone, to be able to just be with them, listen to them, see how they tell their story, see the way it affects them, see the way they sit, see the mood that it conjures up in them. You know, there's so much power in that, and you can be so helpful and even just such a good friend by learning to listen, you know, really well. It's an art form, and you know, people often think they're good at it, but they talk a lot more than they listen.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, I'm like, just befriend a therapist and save your money, because we're really good at listening. And that's probably like some of the biggest feedback I get from people professionally and just personally, is that I'm a good listener. And I think that's, you know, I'm grateful for that. That was something I learned, but, and you clearly are too, Karen. we have that ability. So that's a good thing.
Guilty for, you know, like, I mean, everybody should be able to listen, right? You know, but we're being paid for it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not sure when this will air, but we are recording this the day after our first presidential debate in the States. Which was, I don't know the right word.
There wasn't a lot of listening.
There was not a lot of listening. Yeah. Consequently, that is reflected in our national discourse politically right now. So, and I think we're actually going to do a whole new, another podcast on that coming out soon, on kind of intellectual humility and how we can listen better to each other. But I want to ask you really quickly before we get off, your book, The DIY Guide to Living Well in a Crazy World. That's not your book. The book is The Busy As... Can I say it on the air?
Sure, of course.
I cannot let you get off until you talk about that book. I'm really curious, as a high achiever myself, kind of how, what you wrote about. Like, how can we keep like achieving and doing a lot without all the stress and striving that most of us, that comes with a lot of that high achieving? Tell us about that book.
I really wrote that book because I wanted to write down all the tools that I'd used with clients over the years that had worked. So all the best tools, and I thought, more and more people were presenting, not for busyness per se, mm-hmm. but just because they were trying to manage the craziness of the world and all the demands on them and all that kind of thing. So that's really what it is. It's a collection of tools for helping high achievers or anybody who just is feeling overwhelmed and crazy busy to sort of pull things back a bit. But it's my, I guess, my take on life too. It's my manual for, the best way to live. If that's probably sounds extraordinarily arrogant, but it's just what I've picked up through therapy and what I've learned myself. And, we all need guidance, don't we, on how to live? And I certainly seek the writings of many people. So I thought, I'd make my offering through that book.
So what would be the one big takeaway from your Busy As Fuck book?
I think it's pronounced Busy As Fuck. I think that.
There we go. We'll just say that. What if I really wanted to retrain myself to be less stressful, what would be the big takeaway?
It would be, I guess the themes that come through it are things like what really matters to you, because once you know that, it's much more easy to design your life. Who matters to you? I'm assuming in your case it's each other and your daughter, but how do you prioritize them and say no to all the things that could otherwise distract you from being with people you love and care about and also doing things that you love and care about? Nothing else matters in the end, does it? She was a good therapist. I'd be mortified if I had that written. I want somebody to love me. And I think that's, hopefully that's all about that kind of thing.
That's David Brooks would call second mountain life kind of thinking. Like, really, what's it all about?
I think our two boys would have something to say about just the daughter. But
okay. And the boys, and of course, I didn't know about the lads.
Yes, we didn't mention them. So yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. No, that's good. I think this book has got my name on it. Like, this is the one I need to pick up and really, and I love how you say 10 on the couch sessions to diagnose, explain, and treat busy as fuck people, Chad, everywhere. So I want people to go and we'll put that in our show notes also.
And you can find
I think February, Northern America and Canada.
Awesome. Okay.
Okay. Mm.
So we can, we can definitely link to that when it's available.
Well, Karen, as a takeaway, what are some practices and routines that you incorporate into your own life, just on a regular basis?
What you mean? What do I like doing, or what do I make sure I do every day?
Yeah, like a morning routine or evening routines or kind of like daily or weekly practices that kind of keep you mindful of the work that you so much believe in, not only for your clients, but for yourself too.
Yes, you're right. You have to, don't you? Because you have to walk the talk. You can't be trying to teach people things and then not manage yourself as well as possible. So I'm huge on morning routines. I always get up at 6:15 and I write for 2 hours, and then I go for a run or a walk, have a coffee, some breakfast, do some other bits and pieces during the morning. Then I see the clients in the afternoon. So my day is you know, fairly balanced. I used to see lots and lots of clients, and I found that they probably weren't getting the best of me, and I would sit like a moron on the couch at night staring at Netflix, which mm-hmm. you know, ultimately probably isn't going to, you know, as much as I enjoy a Netflix, it wasn't going to push my life forward. So if you set mm-hmm. your morning upright, you set your day upright. And I do believe in having a bit of exercise and good food. And I like to socialize, so, you know, not extensively, but with people that matter to me. A glass of wine, you know, that kind of thing, bit of music. I've got very simple needs. And as we've all discovered during COVID, you know, sometimes the simple things are really good for you. People have been complaining coming out of lockdown down here that life is too hectic and overwhelming again. And that's really confused them, because although lockdown had its tedium and boringness, it made life very simple, which mm-hmm. was something that I think we were all kind of longing for.
I agree. Yeah. So, I think it felt like what I imagine the 1950s would be like. We gardened, we walked.
I didn't mind it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, those sound like some wonderful routines. So when you talk about you being on the couch, you're talking about listening as a therapist and not binge watching Netflix. Okay.
Maybe both.
So how can people, they can find you, Karen, at on the couch. I think it's .co.
Yep.
And where else?
At onthecouch.co.nz.
Okay.
That's it. Yep.
Yeah, anywhere else that they can find you? And I think you said your book is coming out in the later or winter, January, February.
Yeah, it's on. Yeah, so it's all there, but it's the actual paperback version's coming into the stores and really in the new year.
Fantastic.
Yeah, but if you read that, you'll not need to know anything more about me. That's it.
I love it. Well, this has been delightful to have you on.
Yes, it's been great.
Yeah, for you to share a little bit of your story. I'm glad that your husband is well. I'm glad that you had the courage to come and share your experience with our listeners and be vulnerable like that. And we're grateful.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you so much, guys. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
it has been great. At The Big Self School, we bring you a lot of things, books, podcasts, and classes of all kinds. Right now, coming up for December 15th, we have a live 2-hour workshop. We're calling it our Calm Class. It's short but intense. We'll give you a lot of strategies for working and moving through all of the anxiety that you may be feeling. And also, if you were one of the very first 25 to sign up, we are giving away a free Calm book. The Calm book, I wrote it earlier this year. It's 100 pages. It's a hardcover. It's called What Do You Expect? Discovering Methods for Deep Calm. We would love to see you there at thebigselfschool.com, and it's under classes. See you soon, and thanks for tuning in today.